Morning, Dharma friends.
Yes, brother and sister, Dharma family. Okay, everyone, I think we can begin. Let's begin. So just get comfortable in your seat. I'll just check your back is straight, your hands and feet are comfortable. You can close your eyes or keep them partially open. And just let your body breathe itself. And feeling the body breathe itself. Just relax into awareness. Let the whole ground beneath you appear as lapis lazuli light. As smooth and soft as the palm of your hand. And all of space be filled with offerings and rainbow light. Picture you're surrounded by all sentient beings. In the space above you, in front of you, on a throne, which has a lotus and sun and moon seat upon it, is sitting Lama Tsongkhapa. He is the essence of all of our teachers. And he is surrounded by the assembly of direct and indirect teachers. There are deities, Buddhas, and bodhisattvas. There are heroes, solitary realizers, and Dharma protectors. Recollect that you are fortunate to be alive today. And you have the leisure and opportunity to attain your spiritual goals. But you need to act quickly. Things do not exist as they seem to. And though things are not quite right, you have a spiritual friend leading you in the safe direction of the three rare sublime ones. Imagine yourself to be as clear as a deity holding a vajra and bell and leading all sentient beings in that safe direction of the Buddha, the Dharma, and his teachings. Make this offering of practice purely for the benefit of all sentient beings. And join me in saying, I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. Then see, from the heart of each refuge being above you, lights and nectar stream down, and these dissolve into yourself and all living beings who surround you. Negative karmas and obscurations are purified. Your lifespan, your virtues, and your realizations are increased. Cleansed by wisdom and love, recollect the four immeasurable thoughts of love, compassion, joy, and equanimity. And decide to develop these yourself and to establish all beings in the four immeasurable states. To affirm this, join me in saying, may all sentient beings have happiness and its causes. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and its causes. May all sentient beings never be separated from the happiness that is without suffering. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from the bias of attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. From the heart of the Lama and all the refuge beings above you, lights and nectar stream down, and these dissolve into yourself and all the living beings surrounding you. Negative karmas and obstructions are purified. Your health and lifespan are increased, along with your virtues and realizations of Dharma. So empowered with wisdom and love, relax and invite the field for accumulating merit, which appear, and in their presence you say, reverently I prostrate with my body, speech and mind. I present clouds of every type of offering, actual and imagined. I declare all my negative actions accumulated since beginning this time, and rejoice in the merit of all holy and ordinary beings. Please remain until the end of cyclic existence and turn the wheel of Dharma for living beings. I dedicate my own and others' merits to the great enlightened. So we've purified our body, speech and mind somewhat, we've accumulated merit. To prevent us weakening or losing this, we need to not cling to it as objectively real. Now to stop the appearance of this samsaric world, its inhabitants and enjoyments, we dissolve everything into emptiness and have it reappear as a wonderful pure land that we can offer to the Buddha, appearing as Lama Tsongkhapa. And so we say, this ground, anointed with perfume, strewn with flowers, adorned with Mount Meru, four continents, the sun and the moon. I imagine this as a Buddha field and offer it. May all living beings enjoy this pure land. Idam Guru Ratna Mandala Kamrayatayami. We release the offering and the Lama accepts it and smiles at us with delight. We look up into the eyes of Lama Tsongkhapa, and in his eyes we find immense humility, kindness and acceptance. And from the heart of the Lama and all the holy beings surrounding him, streams of light and nectar flow down, granting blessings and purifying. And we recollect the three principal aspects of the path. And from the heart of Lama Tsongkhapa, infinite light rays emanate, reaching all environments and all beings. Which all dissolve into light and are gradually absorbed into the field of merit. And this dissolves into the Lama. It now diminishes in size, moves through space and enters your crown and descends down to your heart. And his mind and your mind become of one nature. Within that nature, you hear the sounds of the mantra. And you begin to recite it, saying, Om A Guru Vajradhara Sumati Kiti Siddhi Hum. 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 Now from our heart, rays of light fill the ten directions of space. All beings are utterly transformed into the fully awakened state. No difference between self and other. In fact, concepts of self and other are recognized to be just that. And so they don't appear either. Then from the directions of the ten directions of space, life withdraws and re-enters your heart. You feel yourself on your seat, breathing normally and naturally. You understand this meditation is one of imagination, which has imprinted the mind with this potential for your full awakening for the benefit of others. This potential needs to be nourished with study. We need to reflect upon what we study and then realize what we study. I think this is what you wish to do by attending these classes on the Lam Rim Chenmo, the Great Stages, set forward by Lama Tsongkhapa, and explain to us through the kindness of our own teachers. Now breathing in through your nostrils. Exhale through your mouth. Let your eyes flutter open and bring your awareness back into where you are. So this class 20, we're breaking it up into two sections. So today we've got 12 questions along with our answers. Let's have a look at what we've got first. So our first question is, so Lama Tsongkhapa says that those who have developed the view of emptiness in their mind stream may have all three ways of apprehending things as existing. So what are these three ways? Suzanne, would you like to just say, give us one of the ways?
Apprehending it as truly existing.
Okay, fantastic. Delma, what's another way?
Apprehending an object as existing in a false way.
Fantastic. And Caroline, what might be the third way?
Apprehending an object as merely existing.
Yep, that's fantastic. There we go. So first one was what Sue said, what Delma said, and then what you said, Caroline. Then this sort of question is like, explain how these beings would have all three. So, how about you, Linda? You go on the first one. Would you try and do the true existence?
So how would somebody, the question is, how would a person who'd realize emptiness still have that in their mind? Is that the question?
Yep, that's right.
True existence. That was the first one. You got the other
Yes, it
one?
was true existence.
Okay. So when they were out of meditative equipoise and they were in subsequent attainment, they would still see things as inherently existing.
Yes, this is right. Yep. And Sue, what's the next one? The next one will be this false existence, meaning like an illusion.
That would occur when they're either in meditative equipoise and equipoise. I can't get my words today.
Okay.
In meditative equipoise on emptiness, or if they're analyzing still, if they've still got strong conceptions, I think I understand that as if they're still analyzing out of meditative equipoise, if they're still analyzing, then the conception is temporarily not generated, that it's inherently existent.
Okay. And what about the last one? Caroline.
So the last one, that the person who has realized emptiness is definitely out of meditative equipoise, and with the knowledge of emptiness, sees things in a general way, doesn't grasp at
Yep,
them.
that's right. Yeah, you were just seeing it. So this is a little tricky, isn't it? How these beings would have all three. So this is what Geshe-la said, wasn't it? He said they still have a natural true belief, but the habit would fade after their close study and so forth, and they know that. They'll also see things like an illusion because they've actually realized emptiness. And they continue to just see things as just existing in a general sense. He says, those who've generated the view of emptiness of inherent existence within their own mind streams can hold things to exist in any of all three ways, as truly existent, as falsely existent, and as merely existent. After having generated that view of emptiness, and for as long as its influence lasts, when they analyze whether or not things truly exist, the contrived grasping at true existence does not arise within their mind streams for the time being. However, the innate grasping at true existence still arises. At this point, Tsongkhapa is referring to ordinary bodhisattvas who have generated a conceptual understanding of emptiness. So here we've got to be careful, isn't it? It's like whether they've got the conceptual understanding or the direct insight into it. Because there are bodhisattvas that have one or both. They've got direct insight, they've also got a correct conceptual understanding. Because nevertheless, it's important to understand that the innate grasping of true existence still arises, even when the mind streams of those who have generated a direct realization of emptiness, right up until attaining the eighth ground. So this was taken from Geshe Sayadaw in Stages of His Path.
So, Eddie, can you explain that a bit more, like how that is? Because I didn't believe that was actually, like, I didn't realize that was the case. They would still have grasping at innate grasping at true existence, even with a direct realization of emptiness. Because that's what you just said.
So that's so this is the thing of going. So at the eighth ground, what happens? Anybody know?
They start eliminating the cognitive obscurations.
Yeah, that's right. So, and they've realized they've got the same sort of attainments basically, in terms of emptiness, as the solitary realized and the arhats, haven't they? So up to that point, self-grasping still exists. But when they've reached that point, it no longer exists. The innate self-grasping. Otherwise, you'd think, so why are they engaged in this path from the path of meditation onwards? So now we've got the path of seeing, now we've got and it's only one or two moments, isn't it, the path of seeing. From then on, it's the path of meditation. You start going up through all the grounds. And the purpose of going up through the grounds is to rid ourselves of the innate self-grasping. So innate self-grasping is still there for quite some time, for a long time, in fact.
But if the innate self-grasping's there, but if what about the grasping at your own other phenomenon than the self? Is that still there? I thought that, like Linda, that
Yeah,
that had.
so that was like, are you talking about the cognitive observations there, Caroline, or?
Yeah, they're all gone,
No, the
aren't they?
cognitive observations are still there. They're going to be dealt with from the eighth ground onwards.
All right. Cognitive.
So
So
Eddie, is it
got sleep on.
so at the path of seeing, which is very short, we only use our lose our intellectually acquired grasping,
Yeah, that's right.
but still the innate is still present. So we still see things due to imprints as inherently existent because we're so familiar with that once we're out of that meditative equipoise. So that's why we then start on the path of meditation to gradually eat away at that. Is that right?
So there's two things present there, Sue. One is that the cognitive obscurations are still there, so inherent existence still appears. The innate grasping is still there.
Yeah, because we only get rid of the intellectually acquired of that
That's right.
first direct realization of emptiness.
That's right, yep. So the innate grasping is going to continue right up till the eighth ground, isn't it? At the eighth
Yes.
ground, we finally deal with that. And now we still have the cognitive obscurations. And now we deal with those.
So are we dealing with those in meditative equipoise on the eighth ground?
From the eighth ground onward, yes. We no longer have the innate grasping, that's dealt with.
Right.
Now we're dealing with the cognitive appearances, the habits.
Right. So when you're saying we're dealing with them, that's all in meditative equipoise, isn't it?
That's right.
And when we're out of meditative equipoise, we're gathering merit to then, when we go back into meditative equipoise, that we're strengthened our bodhicitta side to be able to then, strengthen our
The power of
examination and
mindfulness.
meditative equipoise.
Yeah.
Right.
So all the way, the you would have a natural true belief at this time, would you? As you already know, it's not natural. I don't have you'd have it. It's just like this. Now at that level, after realizing emptiness and going all the way up after the eighth ground, you know for sure, right? You don't have any grasping. You know that all things lack the true existence they appear to have. So all things have an illusion-like existence. And while you know that, while your eyes are open and walking out in the world, when you get ready to go into meditative equipoise, you're dealing with the cognitive obscurations from the eighth ground onward.
So, what are you seeing again when you're walking around out of meditative equipoise in the eighth ground, when you're on the eighth ground?
All
Are you
phenomena have an illusion-like existence.
It's an illusion. So, whereabouts on the path of meditation, when you're walking around, are you walking around with this illusion-like reality, apprehension?
Whenever you're not in meditative equipoise upon emptiness.
Right.
So when these people are in meditative equipoise upon emptiness, only emptiness appears, doesn't it? Then they come out of it, now you're back in the world, and like you say, Carolyn, you're what can I say? You're gathering more merit, aren't you?
Yeah.
Yeah. So you gather the merit and then you go back and it's the emptiness again. The merit to support the emptiness, the wisdom.
So when you're in meditative equipoise and on emptiness, only emptiness appears, how are you then refining? How are you getting rid of the innate grasping if when you're concentrating, when you're looking at emptiness? That's what I can never don't quite understand. If emptiness is the what you're focused on, then how do these subtleties, how does that and meditating on emptiness, get rid of that innate grasping on.
Okay, so what we call it, so the innate grasping, innate grasping is grasping at something that does not exist. The empty shows you it doesn't exist, it's not there.
So you're saying that that what we're focused on, what object we're focused on in terms of it being empty, becomes more subtle and subtle as you go along?
No, it becomes more and more stronger. The emptiness becomes more, your meditative equipoise, you'll just becoming familiar with what you already know. So it's stronger because, like you say, you created the merit when you're not in meditative equipoise, you're still working.
Okay.
Yeah, it's we like, come... I guess, what could it be like? I don't know whether this is a good analogy or not. So suppose you've been smoking for a long time, and then you become much more aware, of course, of the faults of smoking and how it impacts your health and family and all those sort of things, right? And then you stop. So as long as you keep not ever smoking again, the not smoking sort of becomes stronger against your thing to smoke. So all the time that you no longer smoke and keep reminding yourself, of course, of the faults of smoking, that works against what you used to do. So you have less and less chance of doing what you used to do. So every time you go, like in terms of the emptiness, you're going to see the same phenomena, aren't you? Every time you go back there, which is the empty. And that's just telling you, the self that you thought was there, of course it's not there. You realize that on the path of seeing. But there's still this innate sort of thing, just like even though you've given up smoking, there's still always a chance, isn't there, that you could take up smoking. So you want to get rid of that whole thing idea altogether that I might have another smoke. And so every day, like alcohol is probably a better example, isn't it? You know, one drink and you're gone as an alcoholic. So you have to tell yourself every day, like they say in Alcoholics Anonymous, right? Take a day at a time, remind yourself, and then you've got your sponsors to talk to and all these sort of things. Because, you know, basically the sickness is still there. My strength of will might collapse. I might go back for another drink. I can't allow that to happen. So being in meditative equipoise on empty is just sort of refreshing, reminding, deepening the conviction that, of course, I lack inherently existent self. When you come out of it, this applies to everything. Yet the phenomena still appear to be out there separate from you. So then you decide, everything has an illusion-like existence. The idea that myself is actually a real thing is an illusion. I think that's the best I can sort of do.
Eddie, at the eighth ground, have we got rid of imprints? I can't remember. The eighth ground, we're getting rid of, eighth ground on, we're getting rid of imprints, stains, and the dualistic appearances, aren't we?
That's right.
We're working. That's why we keep concentrating on emptiness.
That's
to
right.
Get rid of those bits.
That's right.
Yeah.
So everything from the first ground to the eighth is we're getting rid of this innate grasping itself. Okay, that's probably the best I can do. Because is there anything sort of like any other questions? Ask a question, even though I've tried to do my best, I don't know whether it's sort of registered or not. Okay, let's have a look at our question three then. It says, in a nutshell, within the middle way for opponents, how do we differentiate the autonomous and the consequentialists? Who'd like to have a go at this one? somebody tell me about the autonomists. Sue, tell me about the autonomists.
They differ because they think that things exist conventionally, inherently.
That's right. They definitely think that, don't they? What else do they hold to be true?
Autonomous syllogisms?
Yep, this is right. So this is the autonomous syllogism, isn't it? So basically, the phenomena conventionally possess an intrinsic nature, and the three modes of the debate are established by valid knowledge of their intrinsic nature by both parties. So this is where their basic thing, isn't it? Phenomena have a conventionally possesses an intrinsic nature, and when they're in the debate, the subject, object, predicate, the whole thing has to be agreeable to both parties, because these phenomena are conventionalities and therefore they have an intrinsic nature. Middleway consequences, as you probably know, there aren't, whether they're conventional or ultimate, they have no intrinsic nature whatsoever. So intrinsic nature is wiped off across the board. And in terms of the debate, these are merely accepted by the opponent. They don't have them, and they don't have an actual intrinsic nature. So, you know, a little while ago when we were doing this material, remember when we talked about the middle way autonomy, and they would put as a qualifier ultimately, and this is not acceptable for the middle way consequence school. So this is here from Geshe Sopa. Chandrakirti made the distinction between the autonomy and consequential methods very clear. An autonomous reason called Svatantra refers to proof of a thesis using a reason established for both parties by means of valid knowledge that is valid regarding the inherent nature of its object. Whereas the middle way, the consequences, does not refer to that method, but instead refers to proof of a thesis using a reason where the three modes are merely accepted by the opponent. Now, in such a proof, the reason need not be established by both parties. So these guys go both parties because phenomena intrinsically exist. These guys, phenomena don't intrinsically exist, so we don't need to have both parties agree. I wrote a new prompt to try and help me understand the material, and I asked it to basically answer what is practical about knowing this? And we came up with this. So this knowledge offers two ways to approach problems. One way seeks a shared, solid basis for agreement. The other reveals flaws within an opponent's own logic. In daily life, this helps us question our own fixed beliefs. By seeing their inner faults, we can reduce stress without needing to replace them with a new absolute truth. So the middle way consequence is really a tool for mental flexibility and freedom. You know how, I changed it again and come up with some a new different way of doing this. So I asked, what are the practical implications of the knowledge today, and what, give me an exercise to do to help me understand this. This comes up in our next question. But can you see when you're when we have arguments with one another, most of the arguments, like we start off with a disagreement on the basis, don't we? Now, then we try to bring it together so that we work out we're both arguing about the same thing. So arguing like about the same thing, this is a bit like what the middle way autonomies do. We've got to have a shared basis of this, of what exists, what we're talking about. The subject has to be shared by both of us. So we both know what we're talking about. In our real life, this is, we often find that out later on, that we haven't been on the same basis, don't we? We've been arguing about different things. So the middle way consequence, that's how they sort of look at it, go, well, okay, we don't need to actually agree on a basis here. I'm just going to take what you're saying and show you the faults of it. So our next question, question four, says, yogic autonomists, like the mind only, assert that sense awarenesses are non-mistaken in one way, although mistaken in another. Explain how this is so. So, Linda, would you like to have a go at this one?
Sure. So, mind only don't accept the existence of external objects.
Yep, that's right.
They say that sense consciousnesses are mistaken because their objects appear to be external objects, although they are not.
Yep.
But they're not mistaken.
Let me just pause there. So that's the mistaken, isn't it?
That's the mistaken
one,
yeah.
That's right. These over-autonomous and the mind only, the mind only, this is what they're saying. And now where are they non-mistaken, Linda?
So they're non-mistaken because they don't say that they're mistaken because they appear to be inherently existent, but they're not. They are unmistaken because they say that they appear to be inherent existence, and that's the way they are.
Okay, that's good. Do people understand this? Delma, what did you come up with?
Well, I think we're probably reading the same text, but I just, that last bit, the first part I had the same about mistaken.
Yeah.
And then the last bit I just put, however, sense consciousnesses are unmistaken with respect to appearing to exist by their own character.
Okay, yeah. So I just put up like this. So for the mind, this mind only holds the autonomy, mistaken regarding the appearing object, right? So if you're looking at blue, it appears that blue is appearing external to your eyes. It's separate from consciousness. So use blue, but you could take any other object in your room and look at it and go, does it look like this object is external from my consciousness? You'd have to say, yeah, of course it does. You might even go, that object is physical form, my mind is not. So obviously they're really different things, and not only that, but that's, you know, over there, my consciousness is over here. So obviously they're separate. Mind only would say, this, you're mistaken about that. Not that these objects are actually separate from consciousness. And this is what Linda said, and I think we could all, if you look through this and go, okay, I get that. Then we have to go, now are we talking about non-mistaken or unmistaken? So non-mistaken regarding the held or the main object, that the blue is blue, you're actually looking at blue. Now blue is appearing, that's correct. There's no mistake there. And it exists inherently. It's not mistaken. Now, so basically, this is just what Linda said.
But what does it mean, Eddie, that blue exists separate from the consciousness? I mean, that it doesn't exist like that. If, you know, it's form. So are they saying there are no five sense consciousnesses? They're all the mental consciousness.
No, the five sense consciousnesses exist.
But then how can it be, if it's mistaken, blue is external and separate from consciousness.
That's right. That's a mistake.
They say that's mistaken. So how can it, so where is the sense, with where is the visual consciousness? For mind only, where's the visual consciousness that would usually see blue as a as its object?
Well, if you look at our normal visual consciousness, right, that we all have, and they know we all have that, and they do too, they just go, where's the blue? And you just look around, like if you've got a blue wall in there and put any blue object in front of you, you'd go, well, there it is. There's the blue. Is that blue appearing to you to be separate from your consciousness, from your visual consciousness?
Oh, I see. Right. And
they go, yeah, of course it does.
Yeah. Yeah. No, got it. So it is an object of the of visual consciousness.
Yes, it is. Yeah.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
So this is okay for everybody? I'll try to make it as simple as, like, you know, I mean, it's not easy to sort of condense everything down into a sort of like a sound bite. But this is basically what it's getting at. Now our next question asks, why can there be no commonly appearing subjects for the middle way consequences and the autonomists?
Yeah, sorry, I've got a bit unstable internet today, but I'm still here.
Okay.
There's no commonly appearing subjects because they can't agree on what is valid or mistaken. And also, so that makes it unestablished because they're not agreeing on it. What one thinks is mistaken, the other one thinks is not mistaken, basically.
So this okay for everybody? This is that in a nutshell, right? They, in essence, they lack a shared reality.
So, Eddie, this is sort of what we did last class, isn't it? It's
Yep, that's
going
right.
over,
Yeah,
you know,
you. That's right.
reinforcing.
That's right. And you'll see this again, like next week, next fortnight too. They're grabbing material from like this one and the one before, and it's sort of all just sort of around this here.
They really must want us to understand that because
I
it's
think.
coming up a lot of times today and last time. I just
That's right.
wanted to establish it's not a new point, it is the same one being gone over and
That's exactly right. So there's
right.
another class on where, so the class after next week's class, there's a question in there too, like this, you know, and I'm just going, I'm sure we've answered that question. And they're going back, yeah, there it is, like two classes back. There's the question and the answer. They just reworded it, you know. Yeah, basically, please say it again, Sue. What Sue said is quite correct. They just have a disagreement on what's valid. Yeah, they disagree with what is valid, and then and also in terms of this the syllogisms.
And Eddie, do they disagree on what's valid because of this belief in inherent existence and this lack of belief in inherent existence?
Yeah,
Is that
that's
the reason
right.
why they don't
Yeah,
agree?
that's exactly right. Yep, that's right. Let me see what it says, one of the things I had here. Yes, it's like a scientist and a dreamer arguing about the physics of a dream. You know, one analyzes is the dreams the reality of the dream. The other one knows it's a dream with no substance whatsoever. So there's just no meeting here. Yes, like one is positing inherent existence, one is saying no such thing. So, yeah, you can't, yeah, there's no shared reality here. So question six asks, how would any subject, these essentialists, so the essentialists are basically, so essentialists is basically referring to anybody who holds the view of inherent existence, substantial existence. And basically everything below the middle way consequence school is can be referred to as an essentialist position. There is something essentially there. So the question is, how would any subject, these essentials put forward, therefore, have to be an unestablished subject? So I'll put this picture up like, yeah, you must have heard the story of like the one of the arguments the middle way consequence put up. They say that if phenomena were to inherently exist or intrinsically exist, they'd be like flowers existing in the sky. Yeah, they're as real as that. But of course, you know, the middle way consequence, there are no flowers in the sky. Right? So this will say, look, that subject is not established. So this, like, I saw put up an imaginary castle floating around in space, you know, and we're all talking about it, and these guys are going, Eddie, there are no castles in the sky. That subject is not established. So the subject's very existence is the point of disagreement. Middle way consequences say, look, truly established entities are like impossible. They just don't exist at all. So the subject that you're talking about is a non-existent. Is this okay for everyone?
It's
Yes,
just
subjects are
going
not
round the
existent.
same subject, isn't it?
That's right. We're coming at it from, I don't know, sort of slightly different questioning approaches, but it's just the way of us to get familiar. There's a major difference here between the middle way autonomy schools and every school beneath them. Now, every school beneath them is talking about phenomena that have some sort of essential nature, intrinsic nature, inherent nature, natural nature, a nature whereby the characteristics of the phenomena exist from their own side, all that sort of stuff. And middle way is saying, those subjects actually don't exist. Well, they don't say that, but that's what they mean. You know, what they do is through their syllogisms help the other person to see, oh, those phenomena are actually not established.
So when they say not established or unestablished, do they mean non-existing?
Yeah, that's right. Inherently existing phenomena don't exist at all. Yeah, so we can't establish them validly.
But on that slide, Eddie, it should be essentialist. Their subjects are not established because how are their subjects not established?
The subjects are not established from the point of view of the middle way consequence.
Yeah, that's right.
They're saying, it's a bit like, you know, when you have, I don't know, when you've had this sort of time and you've had arguments with somebody and there's just no agreement, right? You're both just locked into your side. You can't cross over. There's just nothing in you. You know, either you get really frustrated and walk away or just go, oh, whatever. It's a bit like that. So, you know, in one way, in ordinary ways, like you can't get their point. Right? Well, the middle way consequence is saying, yeah, the point that you're brought up, it doesn't exist at all. No such phenomena. That subject, there ain't nothing like it. Inherently existent flowers or castles don't exist, but castles do. We're fine talking about castles, but not inherently established castles. Yeah, so that inherently established castle is a subject which is not established through valid awareness.
But Eddie, with all of this, I mean, I remember you said a few classes ago when I asked that the essentialists all believe in dependent arising, but you said that the causes and conditions of the are essential, are also, you know, truly established in the essentialist view.
No, that's right. And this is the same thing when it comes to the syllogism.
You know? Yeah.
So there's, so the material of the syllogism is a conventionality and it essentially exists. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so dependent arisen phenomena have a true existence.
So why don't they take more about reminding us about that? Because that's, you know, that was quite important for me to understand when you're then looking at the syllogisms of, you know, why some of the syllogisms aren't established from the consequential school because of that issue.
Well, I think what we need to remember here, although they're calling these sort of as schools and so forth, and tenant systems, within those tenant systems are people like us. And so we're moving from, you know, like in stages, like when we go to school, you know, you go up from kindergarten, you move up through the schools, and as you go along, you abandon certain knowledge and you adopt new. It's sort of, it's like this here too. So I remember one time, what's his name? There's a great teacher within the Gelupa tradition. So he was a firm believer, firm a proponent of mind only. And then he said, so, in fact, he ran a college for all the students. And so, but he would keep going along to school, you know, keep listening to teachers by His Holiness, and then one day it was like the penny dropped. And then, okay, now he's moved. Right? Now he's no longer a mind-only proponent tenant holder. So, sort of like that. Yeah. It's not that they're going to keep on to this forever, you know. I mean, they know it's the whole system built here. But it's just that they say, well, this is where I'm up to. This is all I can comprehend. This is what makes sense to me. But I'll keep listening. You know, I'll keep thinking about it. And then something shifts over time. So, now, this is in a similar way to his previous reasoning regarding the subject. How does Lama Tsongkhapa demonstrate that the reason is also not established? So Sue, would you have I got this one?
It's just a parallelism or whatever you call it. It's just the same. For the same reason, the subject's not established, because it's not established by valid cognition, either is the reason, according to the consequence school, established by the valid cognition.
Yeah, I think so. Eh? It's just like, if you don't have one, you can't have the other. It's a sort of, I think it's a nice, simple way of putting it, Sue. So just as they saw here that if you find that one, that its true establishment is impossible, but then everything that follows from it's going to be impossible too. It just, like I say, it doesn't add up. You can't have one part that's false that's going to lead to a truth.
Eddie, did I also read correctly that it's because similarly there is no inherently existent reason?
Exactly, Chris, that's good. I'm sorry, but I would have asked you to say something before. You're just not appearing on my little picture here.
No, that's fine, Eddie. I think, like Sue, my internet has been up and down. It kicked me out completely at one stage, but I'm certainly here listening intently.
Okay. Yep. I've got a little black square with you, so I know you're there. Now, that's so. I think the way you said it, Sue, is, and what you just said there, Chris, it's like this is the easiest way to get at it, right? If you've got one part of a syllogism and you can refute that part, then and say that, well, that's not inherently established. Every other part's not inherently established either. And our next little part deals with a slightly different aspect of it. So let's have a little break. My time says like 11 o'clock with 10 past suit everybody. Okay, so please get yourself a cup of tea. I'm going to, and I'll see you back here in 10 minutes. Love you all. So this is basically showing us that, you know, the autonomous and the consequentialist really cannot agree on a debate subject, because their ideas of valid cognition are completely different from one another. The debate subject for the autonomous exists inherently, and for this debate topic, for a middle way consequentialist, cannot exist inherently. Because inherent existence does not exist at all. I think this is it in a nutshell. So we come to question nine. Is it question nine or question eight?
Eight.
So question eight says, what is the previously explained method for showing that the subject is not established? Okay, what's the method? What is the previously explained method? Again, it's like you're saying, Carol, we're basically coming at the same thing. We're asking the same thing again and again, I think. Sue, would you like to have a go at this?
Yeah, the previous explained method refers to what we were talking about before, what we use to demonstrate that the subject is unestablished.
Yeah, this is, again, like I said, it's like three or four questions all coming at the same answer, basically, aren't they? So a valid knowledge of intrinsic existence that can commonly establish a subject acceptable to both schools, it cannot be established. Right? There's a huge difference of opinion here between how a phenomena exists and what does awareness validly get at? Now, one school is saying, well, it's valid. It's getting an intrinsic existence. So that's valid. These phenomena appear to exist that way. This is for real. So they have different standards for real make agreement impossible.
I like what Linda asked before when she said, is established the same as existent? Because if you look at the definitions, you know, for an established base, that which is established by valid cognizer or valid cognition, And they're not agreeing on that. So there can be no established base, or there can now be no existent. So the definitions of those two come into play.
Yeah, it was good. Yeah, you can show you how important definitions are, isn't it? And like if you forget them, it's like, oh. Then we have our next question is, how does Lama Tsongkhapa explain Chandrakirti's claim that Baba Vivekananda accepts that the reason is not established? So this is, and my answer, I'm not quite so sure of here. So I'd like to see what you guys have to say. And like that, Linda, like you don't, I had the same thing. I'm going like, what are...
I couldn't work it out, Eddie. I'm just like reading, then I got like, I'm over this. I'm going now.
I was the same. I was trying to work out myself. This is very difficult. I'd like to hear what people have to say. So please.
I'll start. Exactly like Linda, and I thought I'll come back to it, and I went back to it, and I thought I still got no idea. I couldn't.
So I put an answer, and I'm not convinced it's correct. I don't know. But let's have a look. Let's see what we do have. So, Caroline, would you like to go first?
I started off like the others, but the only thing that I kind of, looked through, that it seemed to be, this is where the issue of what do the two truths say. So it was sort of like introducing the idea, well, the two truths, and we know one is the truth of conventional existence, one's a sort of truth of ultimate existence, and that he was trying to say that Baba Kavika actually is in some ways, getting the two truths wrong from the point of view of the consequence school in terms of how the logic can go through. Like if the consequence school is about upending the logic of the essentialists, then he was saying that the type of valid cognition from the two truths is not accepted because it posits the two truths still on inherent existence. So that's sort of, I was going round and round. But the two truths and the valid cognition from the two truths is what I kind of got as some new thing.
Okay. Yeah, good, good. Sue?
Yeah, this was really confusing. I think I agree with Carolyn. It's Baba Vivekananda was refuting it because he said the Tathagata said so, and he had arguments to back that up. And it did relate back to saying talking about the two truths then, the coming in. But how to put all that in words, I don't know.
Yeah, that was the difficult part, isn't it? How to put it into words. And, So, Chris, how did you go?
So we're similar to everybody else. I've got three quarters of a page written here, and it's pretty silly. But anyway, so I also started off with, Chandrakirti citing Baba Vivekananda's analysis in terms of two truths. That sort of came to a conclusion that Baba Vivekananda has faulted the essentialist reason by applying qualification of conventionality and ultimately.
Yeah.
So his arguments would be a self-contradiction. And then I read further, and like everybody else, went back to it. But then I came up with something about, ultimately it came down to what type of valid cognition establishes the reason. Point one, is it an unmistaken valid cognition that establishes the reason? If so, then it is not established for consequentialists. Or is it a mistaken valid cognition that establishes the reason, then not accepted by the essentialists or autonomists? Eddie. Ultimately.
I get it. So this is, so I'm not too far off, and I hope, somewhere I meet some of your stuff here. So in a nutshell, I thought this is what he does. You've got to analyze your opponent's reason using the two truths. So that's it in a nutshell. However, this is what also I come up with. Chandrakirti reinterprets Baba Vivekananda's own method of analysing an opponent's reason by the two truths. General Curley shows that this translates to whether the reason is found by a mistaken or a non-mistaken valid cognition. Autonomists, like Bhava Viveka, require reasons established by non-mistaken perception of inherent nature. However, consequentialists say such a perception does not exist, even conventionally, as all conventional appearances of inherent nature are mistaken. Therefore, any reason Bhava Viveka posts, if truly established for both parties, be a non-mistaken perception of inherent nature, again becomes an unestablished reason for the consequentialists. And so he goes up like looking at these two truths. Now, so when we the consequentialists and the middle way autonomous meet in terms of ultimate truth, don't they? They both agree that ultimately all phenomena lack inherent existence. Yeah. But then now you come back to the conventional, and now Bhava Viveka says, oh yeah, but these are inherently existent. And you go, like, why? And then he goes with this valid perception and so forth. And then the middle way come in and say, well, we don't see that at all. There's no meeting here. So like I said, the simplest thing I could put up was just this, the two truths is the way to go at it. Yeah, I mean, it's really hard to answer this question, but like it comes down to the two truths. And then like the stuff you're saying, Chris, about this idea of what's a valid cognition. It's really strange, isn't it? Like if you go back and you go, because it's a valid cognition to see that conventional phenomena have an inherent existence, and then go after the ultimate and examine ultimately, they don't. Because you're looking at ultimate truths, aren't you? So this is really mixed up if you take, and this is what I think Chandrakirti was doing with Bhava Viveka's work. Okay, like this part here, doesn't make sense. In fact, it undermines the middle way. So,
Yeah, I agree, Eddie. That's a really good point. That sort of when you look at it through, I was thinking to myself, well, how can they be middle wayists if this is what they're thinking?
Yeah, well, like the middle way on terms of the ultimate truth. but definitely not, because you know, the other people don't take that view. The phenomena ultimately are empty of inherent existence. All the other systems say, yeah, they're empty of something, but not inherent existence. They have other claims about what they're actually empty of. Yeah, so you could say they're middle way in terms of, but not, at least look, you really damage it actually by making conventionalities have inherent nature, and then on the other side going, they don't. I mean, what are we talking about here? Well, we know it's interesting because we're quite confused. It's like, we've got a lot of questions to ask about it, going, I don't get this and I don't get that. So, oh man. And you know, so I have a meditation here which has disappeared from my page. So I don't know what's happened there. And my other one too. So whatever happened, I had two meditations. So I don't know what's happened here. They've not come out. So I don't have them here. I don't know why, but I created them and they're not on my book pages. So we just have to go past that.
Eddie, if you ever find them, can you just email them to us?
Sure. Yeah. Okay. No problem. Yeah, because they're quite interesting. I mean, they're interesting. They do the job. Strange too.
Meditations are really good, Eddie.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you. Okay. So we have this question here. So, what is an unmistaken consciousness for a middle way consequence tenant holder? Chris, would you like to do this one?
Yes, Eddie, it's the sublime wisdom of a noble being being in meditative equipoise upon emptiness.
I thought you'd been copying me, but you're quite right. this is right, right? If you're, that's an unmistaken consciousness. Present. So I wonder, what's one of the reasons why it is unmistaken? Can anybody suggest an answer?
Because they see things as they really exist.
That's right. Emptiness exists as it appears, and conversely too. There's no mix up here. Appearance and reality are the same. There's no contradiction. It's not like we look at the contradiction, we look at conventionalities. They appear to have inherent existence when they don't. Emptiness is empty. One of the reasons for that is like it's a negation. The other side's always positing something positive. Okay, so now for the middle way consequence, the object of unmistaken consciousness. What is the object of an unmistaken consciousness? Delma?
The ultimate truth.
Fantastic. The ultimate truth. That's right. See, the ultimate truth, which is an emptiness from the middle way consequence point of view. Now, from the middle way consequence point of view, what's the object of a mistaken consciousness? Linda. I can't hear you, sweetie. Your thing is switched off.
Did it work now? Yeah, okay, good. So the conventionally existing objects that appear to be inherently existing.
Exactly. That's exactly right. These are the objects of mistaken consciousness. Conventional phenomena that appear to be inherently existent. Again, I had stuff written, and for whatever reason, it has not come out. Man, that's disappointing. You see, when you put so much effort into doing it, you know, I kind of like spend a lot of time doing this. So I'm sorry. I will have a look and see where these things are, and if you like, I'll just send you out the file, right, so you guys can have a go through it and see what's there. So basically, we've gone through these 12 questions, and we've got like I think 13 to complete. So it's the same. So when you're going over the material, remember we're still on the same class. It's the same material. It's just the rest of the questions. And have I sent them out to you, the other 13, or not?
No, not yet, Eddie.
Okay, well, I'll do that this afternoon. Okay, so I'll send those other 13 out to you. And my apologies for this. Okay, so let's end of our class. It's a bit early, but I think that's okay.
Yep. Just a question, Eddie. Just with that one on the object of an unmistaken consciousness and ultimate truth, emptiness. Yep. So, could you say also or contemplate that the object is in fact the nature of that emptiness is the nature of all phenomena. So, is the object the nature of all phenomena is emptiness, or just trying to get that whole thing of the nature of all objects or phenomenon, or it's just me trying to remind myself that emptiness isn't the emptiness of nothing, like it's only.
I think when we use the word nature, it's a bit tricky. Because you can go off to the conventional nature, but actually here we're looking at the ultimate nature. I was hearing Rinpoche saying one time, all objects have a nature, and it's not necessarily emptiness, although that is the deepest nature.
Nature,
if you put the deepest nature of all phenomena, the ultimate truth or something like that, fine. It's just, I'm sure.
So what's how do you define the other nature then?
What's the nature of fire? So it's a conventional nature. You might say hot.
Yeah, right.
So they have these conventional natures, they just don't intrinsically exist.
Right. Yeah. Good. Thank you.
Okay.
Eddie, before you start, before you start winding us up, I do think we should actually all take a minute just to rejoice in our virtues, because we've been doing this. We started this Lamrim Topics, the Lamrim Chemno, on the 8th of February 2015. So we've been going for 10 plus years. And I've got that written up because I've got the notes from the first one that we ever did. And it just inspires me so much. So I wanted to share it with all of you that were there for the very first one.
Thank you, because the time just flies by. So I just take it from day, week to week, and then you realise Jesus, we're all here like 10 years ago doing this.
You're young then, Delma.
much smarter as well, probably.
Elmer, a few people have asked me, and I've been saying, oh, we've been at it about 7 years, I think. So, no, thank you for the correction.
Well, yeah.
Eddie, thank you for, you know, personally, you. Just my tremendous growth just through
thank
this.
You, thank Eddie.
You, Eddie. I just think it would be a lovely gift to offer Rinpoche, wouldn't it?
Absolutely. I've been thinking about that a lot, actually.
Yeah. And the material we're going through at the moment has been very useful in our DB modules, because some of the students are getting ahead and they ask questions. I go, oh, we're just covering that. We're just doing that right now. And so I can answer it, because if we weren't, I'm sure I'd be stuck straight away. You know.
Very thankful. Wow. Thank you.
Okay, no, thank, and you know, for you guys, that means because of you, I've had 10 years of study of this. So I really appreciate it.
So if everyone, I'm actually going over to deliver stuff for Venerable Sering this afternoon. So I will mention to her that we've done this for 10 years and maybe make an offering on everyone's behalf.
I actually think it would be really nice for all of us to do that.
Yeah, true.
Everyone to do it together.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've been thinking
about Gessler recently and, you know, wondering how he was. And I think this would be a lovely offering, just to know that we're still here, we're still studying his teachings. You know, and it's his commentary, his explanation.
Maybe we could take a gallery screen shot, and you could send it off in an email to him, Eddie.
Well, if you know how to do that, I'm fine with it. I just don't know how to
everyone,
do that.
Would everyone be happy with that?
Fully supportive.
Yes.
Yep, so you can do it. Go right ahead.
So Eddie would have to go to his screen so you could get the biggest gallery view of everybody.
Okay.
So if you take your, if you stop sharing your PowerPoint.
Yep. Okay, stop share.
There you go.
Yeah.
So we're all up little gallery, are we?
Yeah.
There's a gallery.
Yeah.
So somebody take the snap.
Yep. Wow.
Okay. Thank you, Gessler.
That lot.
Thank you so much. Yeah, and thank you. Yeah, thank
you. Have you done it, Delma?
We can't hear you, Delma. Hear you. You're lost again. Yep.
Best way to hear me, so I'm silent. just there going you go. To check. Let me just check the shots and just let me see.
Yeah.
So have we all got our hands up? Maybe if we can.
Well, I couldn't because I was taking the screenshot.
No.
But Linda.
Take two or three and choose the best one, Delma.
Yeah.
The one you like.
Looking good, peoples. Yeah, I think there's a good one in there. Okay.
Thank you. Okay, now let's.
Good one, Delma.
Yeah, great idea. And you too, Caroline. Great idea. Good ideas.
I was just wondering the other day about who used to be with us in the group when we used to do them in Langley Tampa Centre. I was trying to think of who was there, and I couldn't think of who wasn't there anymore. But anyway.
Yeah.
Susie Cooper.
She didn't come very much, I don't think.
And then Rosemary was there.
Rosemary for a few months. Yeah, Bob Duffy.
Yes, like 10 years, though. So it's quite remarkable, isn't it, when you think of it, like, stick around for 10 years to make a text.
Casey and Ryan started off.
That's right. Well, we were downstairs.
Didn't stay long.
And it sort of changed over time. So it wasn't always slideshows. It was often we were sitting down talking.
So how are those people? How is Susie and Barbara? And I never see them.
Yeah, we're the same.
See them from time to time. They're good. Still practicing, still going to courses, still doing stuff.
Yeah,
I see them sometimes. Yeah.
I mean, the whole idea behind it all isn't really just to have a more wisdom, more compassion, just be good people while we're alive here on this planet, and then over time become super mundane. Fully enlightened. But here we are as ordinary people just doing the best we can. Okay, let's dedicate. So due to the merits of these virtuous actions, may I quickly attain the state of a Guru Buddha and lead all living beings without exception into that enlightened state. May the supreme jewel, Bodhicitta, not yet born arise and grow. May that born have no decline but increase forevermore. And as long as space remains, as long as sentient beings remain, may I too remain to dispel the sorrows of the world. For His Holiness, the wish-granting, wish-fulfilling jewel, source of every single benefit and happiness in this world, to the incomparably kind Tenzin Gyatso, I beseech, may all your holy wishes be spontaneously fulfilled. And for Rinpoche's fifth return, in holding and spreading the Muni's precious and complete teachings through explanation and practice, you wore the armor of patience that is never discouraged. Incomparable, Venerable Guru, to you I make this request. The armor of patience that is never discouraged. Here we are, 10 years later. That's us.
Joyous effort.
Joyous effort in practice, in